turns around and goes, shh.
Yo, sucker, you got a big mouth. Boom.
Girl, your stare, those eyes,
love it when you look at me, baby.
Your lips, your smile,
love it when you kiss me, baby.
Your hips, those thighs.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 3 of the Mr. Baby Podcast. In this week's episode, we sat down with a group of our friends, Annie, Jenny, and Clarissa. And they told stories of growing up and traveling abroad, wanderlust as they work around the globe, and of course, the great story of Moosh. So without further ado, enjoy this all-ladies edition of the Mr. Baby Podcast.
Bend over, you know how we do it. The shows bring heat, the cold, the snipe, so ferocious.
So we have more guests than usual this time. We got three of our friends from Shanghai and abroad, who are all in town at the same time, luckily. And they're all captive in my house, so they have to do this for me. but we all kind of met in Shanghai, even though we're all from really different places. So just to introduce everybody, we have Annie from Hong Kong. Hi, Annie.
Hi, am I allowed to talk now?
Yeah.
Okay, hi.
We have Jenny in from Paris.
Hi.
And Clarissa, who's our hometown hero.
Hey.
And Sean, of course.
Yes.
So we met like probably 4 years ago, and then since then a bunch of us have moved away and, you know, come back and have reunions once in a while. But we refer to each other as honey badgers just because of the honey badger don't give a damn video. Like, all of us is a little bit vicious in our own way. So it's a very affectionate nickname. So we're just going to do a 60-second life story with each of you. You're on the clock. So, Annie, why don't you tell us your whole life story, starting now.
I was born in Hong Kong, moved away when I was one, went to Canada, then Singapore, then New York, back to Hong Kong for the last 2 years of high school, college in Buffalo, Ohio, and then Shanghai, and back to Hong Kong.
What school did you go to? What college?
Oberlin College. We had the nation's largest, biggest Walmart a mile from us, and llama farms. And if the wind shifted a certain way, you could smell the manure from stables close by.
Llama
yeah,
stables.
Yeah, llama stables.
Oberlin's a very experimental, ultra-liberal school, right?
It's very hippie.
Yeah, I had some friends who went there.
I learned how to build an igloo to hotbox in, even though I didn't actually smoke at that point in time. I played the didgeridoo, I climbed trees, didn't know how to get down, all that good stuff. My first year in college.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
What was that, abbreviation that you told me that you used in the quad a lot? Like, cis norm or something?
Heteronormative? Hetero?
Maybe. Maybe.
Oh, tro.
Oh, my God.
Tro for hetero.
Tro.
Yeah.
That's so tro, bro.
That's basically how it is.
Yeah, I can just imagine, like, the type of conversations where you would have to use that.
No, you know how we use the word basic now? Replace that with tro, and that's about right.
Wow, oh, yeah. So it was, like, it was more appealing to be, like, I don't know, I guess, like, queer-leaning or, like, liberal.
I don't know because...
I mean, did you feel discriminated against because you're tro? Because you're, like, so tro?
No, but then they were also very racially sensitive, so I'm the Asian chick making all these racist jokes, and people are like, no, but it's not funny. I'm like, no, but I'm Chinese, and I'm really fucking funny, okay? Or people would get offended for me when people made Asian jokes.
Mm-hmm. And I don't care.
Yeah, be like, no, wait, I know a really good Jew one. So, I never felt discriminated against, but I definitely wasn't politically sensitive or racially sensitive, so maybe there's a lot that I missed.
Maybe. So, you've been back in Hong Kong for a couple of years now. Can you tell us a little bit about the business you run with your sister?
So it's a startup that I started doing with her about 3 years ago when I moved back. It's organic skincare and makeup. And it's mostly retail, but we do a little bit of wholesale as well.
How did you guys get into that?
not make this a pun, very organically. We literally are allergic to everything. I have to carry around my own toothpaste because I'm allergic to Colgate. You know, stuff like that. Literally.
Wow, I didn't know that.
No, this is why you have another toothpaste in your bathroom right now. That's mine, and I travel with it. So we started, when we were young, we always had these rashes and everything, and we used a lot of steroid creams, but then my eldest sister, you know, as time goes on, people are talking about natural and organic, and she started buying for the family. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, she worked at Citibank, and all her colleagues would be like, oh, buy some for me too. And her friends would be like, oh, buy some for me too. She's like, I'm basically buying wholesale already.
Uh-huh.
Let's just start something from it. And we have to do all this research for ourselves anyways, and you'll never find a better guinea pig than my family. Between us, we have 99% of the world's allergies covered.
Oh, wow. So it's all everyone in your, are all the women in your family?
No, my mother's actually really normal, so she's our control.
Mm-hmm. She's just like, oh, it smells nice.
Everything dermatologically terrible stems from my father. The man cannot wear anything except for 100% cotton and silk. I'm really glad he went into banking and started making money because, oh my god.
That's wild. Well, I mean, I'm sure it helps a lot with all the pollution and all of the sun you guys get, right?
Yeah, and so now I carry an umbrella or have a sun hat that's like a visor and it rolls up and soccer moms have it and I'm just like, I'm fine with it. I'll look young in 5 years and you'll be old. A Turkish girl who's putting suntanning oil on and going to the beach.
But the brands you guys purchase from, they're sort of from all over the place, right?
All over the place, including Malaysia and South Africa. Mm. So, you know, and of course, like New Zealand, Australia, US, those are the big ones that everybody knows as well. And we do it that way because it helps to have somebody that's certified organic. You know, as someone who sells, it's easier to sell it that way and have a trusted brand. There actually are a lot of startups in Hong Kong that make their own stuff, but I don't know where they source from.
Mm.
And just if people don't know us, then I can just say, okay, you don't trust me, but here's a trust mark that is actually quite difficult to get. And it's expensive for a company to invest in it because these are not non-profit organizations where you have to get these certificates.
Mm-hmm.
So it just helps a lot with the trust thing until they start to get to know us.
Right. Well, you guys don't just carry skincare. You have makeup and pretty things like that.
We have makeup that sells probably quicker than skincare does. One, because skincare, you never really think about it, but then when you try to sell, you're like, oh, nobody is okay having like five different serums at one time. But how many women do you know who are like, oh, I don't need another black eyeliner, but why not? And so you end up having like five red lipsticks, six different black eyeliners, and you swear all of them are a little bit different.
Sure, yeah.
I'm sure it's also like skincare stuff is, there's no instant result. So you kind of have to take it on faith. That it's like, no, just keep using it, it'll work.
Yeah, and makeup is the fun stuff. Whenever we have people come over, they'll spend maybe half an hour in skincare and an hour trying literally only 8 different lipsticks. But they'll spend an hour with it, and they'll just be like, so I'll be here on my computer doing work, you have fun. I'll still be here an hour later.
So how's it working with your sister as your boss, and how often does your work involve shirtless men?
Unfortunately, not enough. And
what was that for? Was it like a fair or a design festival or something?
We were doing a pop-up, and the woman who organized it has her own company, but she also happens to have a fiancé, I think now husband, who modeled for Abercrombie. And so those were his Abercrombie buddies going like, hey girls, we're naked. I was like, yay, unity! Let me call up my friends!
Hard day at the office, I guess.
So many happy women then. So many happy women that day.
Did you sell better?
Huh?
On that day?
Everybody's so distracted. Don't be sold. We're just staring at men. It was also the same pop-up. I love this pop-up. That was the most fun I've had in a while. Where we're in there, it's a slow time, no more models, and all of a sudden you see this Hummer roll up on this small street that nobody usually goes to.
Uh-huh.
And out pours like five really jacked, really hot men. I'm just like, what is going on? And all the store owners in the pop-up are women. So everybody's clustered around the windows. And then you see them just get out in the street, start changing clothing. They're clearly doing a photo shoot. And I was like, oh, I recognize one of those guys. He came and bought a cream yesterday. So I run out with some testers. I'm like, hi, guys.
He came and bought a cream yesterday.
Yeah. Because he was, like, checking out the store. It's like, so I remembered him. And you're clearly gay, so we'll get along fine. Me and gay men. Lots of mutual love. So I rush out with some testers. I was like, hi, I don't know if you remember me, but could you pose with my product since you're doing a photo shoot anyway? And they did.
Oh my god!
That's why some of the photos that are posted on our door that you see, that was from that time where I was like, thanks guys! And one of them tried to be shy, but he got egged on by all the other guys. So one of them is like a chestless, very hot, very gay man, and his equally gay friend is like writing in sunblock, like the name of our company, on his chest. And the other, and the one straight guy is like, no, I'm really shy, really shy. So they make him sit on a staircase, and they plop a big jar of cream right between his legs.
Wow.
They're like, show some thigh.
That is some genius marketing.
I know. And so all the other store owners, including my sister, were in the pop-up store, and they're like, oh my gosh, she's so shameless. And I'm going to have the best pictures, guys. It'd be great. I don't remember the first question.
How's your sister as a boss?
It's really evened out. So at first she was the boss because, I mean, anybody who has a financial control will still always be the boss, no matter how 50-50 you make it. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of business. But
I didn't mean to insult you.
Oh, no. I mean,
you can be the boss anyway.
No, that's just the way of it, though. I mean, whoever holds the purse strings will have the final say, long and short of it. So it started out where we worked out barely 50-50. But then as time goes on, and then up till now, she's only doing the financials, like for accounting, you know, maybe like monthly stuff, and I literally do everything else. So it doesn't really feel like working with her as much anymore. Doesn't also feel like she's my boss anymore, but to that I would say, if you have two older sisters, never work with the one that's closest in age to you, work with the older one, because coming from a very traditional Chinese family, I already used to obeying her. And not arguing with her. So.
Well, thank goodness for that.
I know. No, and it works really well because she also knows how to manage people just from her other work. So she's very careful not to micromanage.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think we went over 60 seconds, but why don't we move on to Jenny?
So, I was born in China, and my family and I, we moved to Paris when I was 4, so I grew up in France until I was 13, and then my dad got expatriated back in China, so the whole family moved to Shanghai, and we lived here for 5 years, and for high school, after high school, we moved back to France, and I studied there also in some kind of, like, not experimental, but at a very liberal school. So I studied politics, and then I went into marketing. And so after doing a series of different retail jobs and internships, I ended up living in China, and I worked for LVMH Group for almost 3 years. And then I moved back to Paris 2 years ago. So I'm living in Paris right now.
Where in China were you born originally?
So I was born in Beijing, and my grandparents come from Manchuria.
Mm-hmm. How come your dad got expatriated?
So he was the Chinese guy who knew French and was an engineer. And when they started...
He just knew French?
He knew French, and that was like one of the only Chinese guys that could speak French back at the time.
Oh, wow.
Because his company is French, and... When they started expanding their operations in China, they wanted someone that could understand the French culture, but also the Chinese one.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, actually, I followed his steps pretty closely because the job that I do today is also bridging between different cultures. So that's why we came back to Shanghai in 2002.
Mm-hmm. What's your kind of role now that you've transferred back with LV in Paris?
So basically, when I was working in China, my job was to do the selection and basically encompass the training for the stores that we have here in China, and in charge of the buying as well. So you go to Paris and you look at the selection of products that come from the central marketing team, And then you choose the kind of assortment that would be the best for your stores, according to Chinese clients' tastes.
Hmm.
And after that experience, I transferred back to the headquarters. So basically now I'm the person hosting all the different buyers coming from all around the world.
Oh, wow.
And so basically working on the editing before it's actually shown to the buyers.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from a series of maybe 500 products, but you show like 100 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working with my team to pick up the best options to show
mm-hmm.
to the buyers.
Do you think if you transferred to New York, you would do kind of something similar to that?
So basically that would be going back to my old job,
uh-huh.
which is flying back to Paris and choosing things for like a different market.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I think my whole life I'm just going to do that for the rest of my life, which is be in France for a couple of years and then maybe seek some other adventures in other countries and then go back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, you seem really comfortable in a variety of different cultures.
I think actually as soon as I get in the same area for 2 years, I start getting like a wanderlust feeling. So I'm never really satisfied to like live in one culture at once.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was living in Shanghai, I missed Europe a lot. And now that I'm back in Europe, I just feel like I need to be enriched with other cultures as well.
Uh-huh. Did you kind of always know that you would end up working in luxury? Because I feel like there's other kind of aspects of your personality that are so, like, they're so out there.
No, actually, I didn't think that I was going to end up working in luxury. I started studying politics because I wanted to be a diplomat at first, and working in international relations. And during my studies, I really enjoyed learning a lot about world history, geography, geopolitics. But little by little, what really came to me was that what I enjoy is sociology, which is like what links people, what explains mm-hmm. that people would behave a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
What is the weight of culture, of norms, like into the actions of each of the individual. And so doing that through marketing was more understanding how like people's culture would have an impact on how they consume. And that's how I got into luxury.
Mm-hmm.
Because luxury, at the end of the day, it's quite different from the consumption of any other commercial good. Because people that buy luxury, like when you buy a bag, which is 3,000 euros, you actually want to show something. Like it's a cultural act mm-hmm. almost.
Yeah.
Because if it's purely functional, you don't need to buy a luxury good.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's interesting in my job today. It's because I'm hosting the buyers from all around the world. I need to think ahead of a color. Like, does it mean the same thing for all the different cultures? The sizing, the functions, it's actually quite sociological,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I like it. But there are other aspects, obviously, that I enjoy more, so maybe in a couple of years I'm going to change industry, so we'll see about that.
So I'm really curious as how you ever got into the skateboard scene.
I knew this was going to come up at some point.
I've never heard the answer.
So basically what
it's
happened...
It's always been a mystery.
...is that when I first moved to Shanghai... I wanted to maybe start living a little bit differently after 6 years living in Paris. Like, it's a very elite school. Like, everyone has, like, uncles or whomever, like, working in politics in France. So I just wanted to get into a more casual scene, let's say. And when I first moved to Shanghai, my friend Lily, who's she's Chinese Hawaiian, and we met in London when I was studying there. And so she also moved here at the same time as me. And she was a reporter for one of the magazines. And so she was doing a piece on the skating scene in Shanghai. So one night we were going to a gala. So we were like basically dressed in like ball gowns. And one of her contacts here in Shanghai was like, hey, like we're doing a birthday party for a friend. Like you should come. So this is us, like, showing up at a skater party dressed for a gala, basically. And, yeah, and that's how, like, I met, like, some of the friends that I kept for a long time.
Uh-huh.
Because they were very welcoming. Actually, they thought that we were freaks, but they were too polite to say that. And so that's how we started hanging out.
Wow.
But I was basically, like, all the boys would do skating on the weekends, and I'd be the girl sitting next to them doing my nails. That's how it works.
So basically every Avril Lavigne song is about you. That's my understanding. Sort of also know a lot of, like, DJs and like media people.
That's the same scene actually in Shanghai. Uh-huh. What's great is that the skating scene is very social. So the boys that do skating by night also have a job by day, and they turn out to be very often photographers, videographers, and that's also how we expand from like the one scene to the other.
Sure.
And that's how I met them. And now they're DJing at night in clubs and such.
Uh-huh. So how good are you at skateboarding?
I can push.
Yeah.
I can't flip, but I can push.
Okay. All right, how about you, Clarissa?
So I grew up in Boston and then went to school in D.C., kind of similar to Jenny, actually. I also wanted to be a diplomat. But I think what really attracted me, actually, was the idea of traveling abroad and, like, exploring different cultures, not so much the, not so much politics. I studied Chinese. I actually majored in Chinese randomly. It was one of the 10 Chinese majors in my school.
And how did you randomly choose a major?
Well, my school had a good Chinese department, and I've always liked languages. Mm-hmm. And I came from a high school where I was forced to study Latin. So I was like,
oh, same here.
Oh, really? Yeah. So I decided to try a useful language. And I realized I didn't want to just kind of half-ass it. So I was like, you know, I'm just going to major in Chinese and mm-hmm. try to be as good as I can. My teacher did give us all a fair warning and said that, you know, it's going to take 10 years for you guys to be anywhere close to good in Chinese. At the time, I was like, that's crazy. Of course not. Now I'm just like, she was so right. But I studied abroad in Beijing in 2009, and that was my first time actually in China. And despite or kind of because of the craziness, I guess I kind of fell in love with China, and especially Shanghai. So after my time in Beijing, I came back in the summer of 2010 to Shanghai, and that kind of convinced me that I wanted to actually take the leap and move to the city. So after I graduated, I moved to Shanghai, and I've been here ever since. I got kind of trapped in the Shanghai vortex, but it's been a good 6 years now.
What were your kind of first impressions when you studied abroad in Beijing?
I remember just being so disoriented. Like, it took me probably at least a month to accept the fact that I was actually in China. Mm-hmm. But it was just very exciting because you just saw so many kind of random, crazy, small things that, like, you never could even imagine seeing in America. And I think that's one of the things that really attracted me because I felt you kind of got out of the box of maybe American life where you're, you know, traveling in your car from one kind of very static space to another and you never really see that much. So I just felt like China was very full of life with all its messiness.
Did you travel much before you came here abroad?
Yeah, actually. So my mom is German. She was born in Germany and then moved to America to marry my dad. So growing up, we always went back and forth. Oh. Between America and Germany, because all her family was still there. So I think that also kind of inspired me to take the leap. It just seemed kind of normal that you would, you know, abandon your home country and move to another one. Was familiar a little bit with Europe, so that's why I think China was so attractive as well, because it was just a completely different world.
Yeah, we talked about that with a previous guest about, you know, there's obviously a little culture difference or culture shock going from America to Europe or the other way, but then, like, Asia's a whole new ball game for that. So even if you've traveled between the two, it's like it doesn't prepare you for traveling to Asia for the first time.
Exactly. And I think I almost, like, didn't realize it until I came back to America after my semester abroad. And then the culture shock hit, but it was more of a reverse culture shock. And just, it made me appreciate some things about America as well, but it also made me realize that, like, I wanted to go back to China and spend more time there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something that's really quite unique about your perspective in China is that I think we know a lot of foreigners that live here that are, like, really disenfranchised with China sometimes, and they get so frustrated by that. But you still find it, like, really, really amusing and stimulating and exciting. Like, you never get pessimistic about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I still just really genuinely love Shanghai. And I sometimes ask myself the same question, like, why am I not, you know, frustrated at times? But I think maybe it comes from having, I can speak with people here, and, like, I know a lot of foreigners don't really speak Chinese so mm-hmm. well, so maybe that kind of adds to the frustration if you can't talk.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been lucky because I've met a lot of very patient people who have helped me with my Chinese, I don't feel cut off. I almost feel, like, very much at home here, I guess. And, like, whenever I travel to the States or, like, anywhere else, I kind of look forward to coming back to Shanghai because I have everything in place and it feels a lot like home now.
Mm-hmm. I actually want to ask you about further back in your life story, because I feel like you grew up in a non-traditional household.
Well, I guess the thing that surprises most people about my home is that I never had a TV growing up.
Well, both your parents are professors.
Yeah. Well, my mom is a psychologist and my dad is a physicist.
Okay.
And they are very kind of counter-cultural, I guess. They were former / current hippies. so, I mean, growing up, like, we always had, like, my mom never, I never went to McDonald's or I never had, like, soda in the house and, like, we didn't have a TV. So sometimes people are just like, how did you turn out, like, relatively normal? But maybe they just don't know me well enough.
I remember when I first met you, I made a dumb joke, like, so who was your best friend growing up? Anna Karenina? And you were like, yep, that's a great book.
I spend a lot of time reading. Books were my friend.
But you also had a twin sister? A younger sister.
Yeah. But we're very close, so I feel like we have, like, very much, we're at different aspects of almost the same person sometimes, I feel like. But she's back in New York now, so she's kind of keeping the nest warm for my parents, so they're not putting too much pressure on me to come back.
Well, Annie, I feel like even though we met in Shanghai, our lives have kind of crossed coincidentally in the past.
Yeah. I actually didn't know until, what was it, 5 months after we met that we'd gone to the same middle school?
Middle school,
I went through
yeah.
a lot of schools, so mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure. But I think that was middle school.
Yeah, how long did you live in New York for?
6 years total. So we moved from Singapore and then went to the UN school. Apparently my parents chose that because it was the most, I want to say non-conformist in terms of American style,
mm-hmm.
which, thank God, no offense to other schools, but thank God. And I'd really, like, I'm kind of like Jenny, right? I don't like one situation staying the same all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So after 4 years there, I was, you know, you basically are supposed to just graduate up to the high school in the same school. But I got really bored, so I applied to all these different schools, including Stuyvesant, and also a performing arts school. And I know you went to Stuyvesant, so I got into Stuy. I almost went in. And I was like, no, fuck it. There are so many good academic schools all over the world. I will probably move again and have to go to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's very few performing arts schools that are so cheap and you audition to actually get in. So I ended up going to LaGuardia for a year. And I only went for a year because the deal I made with my parents, specifically my mother, was, no, don't worry, I do not want to become a professional performer. My future will not be that unstable, A. B, I'm only 14, let me have a year of fun.
Oh, wow.
And that was a deal, and that was why I got to go for a year.
Similarly, my parents told me if I wanted to go to art school, then I had to go to Stuyvesant for high school and do math and science for 4 years.
Oh. Ouch.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
But yeah, but I mean, like, I think I reflected on it a lot, you know, mm-hmm. since I've, like, been a working professional about if I had stayed at the United Nations School for high school, I probably would have just done, you know, like, an advanced art portfolio class, mm-hmm. and then I would have probably felt creatively satisfied with that, and then I would have tried to do Ivy League or something.
Yeah.
But because I did math and science for 4 years, like, I was so sick of it that I had to do design.
No, it's true. Like, where you go to school, it really affects you. Because I went to three different high schools, you know, one was the performing arts school, then I went back to Eunice, then we moved to Hong Kong to another international school where I did the IB there. That was fun, especially since I had to take a test to also get into the school in Hong Kong, and their one requirement was, please get yourself a Chinese tutor. Because it was a Chinese international school, and they're like, everything else about you is fine. It's just this one little language issue. I'm not sure you're going to pass the IB if you don't get yourself a Chinese tutor. Then you see where all your influences come from. Like, when you change schools and you're like, oh, because I went to this school, I like this. Otherwise, I would really never have gotten this influence.
Oh, really?
In my life.
Huh.
Yeah, absolutely. If I hadn't gone to the performing arts school and then gone back to much more strict and rigorous academic schools, I probably would never have chosen Oberlin. You know, Oberlin for me was because it was kind of the same thought process, right? I've only lived in big financial cities. I've always gone to these type of schools. That one year I went, like, a little crazy and decided to go to a performing arts school as an Asian kid. Like, all the Asians were in the violin department or piano or clarinet or something. I was basically the only Asian in the vocal department. It just doesn't happen.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I feel like there were also sort of a large proportion of like Hispanic and more rhythmic ethnicities in the dance department because they all were on the gymnastics team.
Yeah, and all my classmates were also mostly Black and Hispanic as well. This is great. This is how you know when you have zero natural accent. The year that I spent in LaGuardia, I spoke Ebonics, and I didn't even try. It was just because everybody around me was speaking it. So, you know.
Oh, wow, at LaGuardia.
At LaGuardia, I spoke
Ebonics.
Behind
Lincoln Center in
Midtown.
Behind
Lincoln Center.
Okay.
No, but, dude, that place was not okay. You know, there's the MLK Junior School, like, right across the small street.
Sure.
And we had to get let out at different times because apparently there would be knife fights between the schools. So we actually got let out of school at different times specifically for that reason.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
So it was a little ghetto, you know? And then there was me going, like, oh, my God, this is so different. Oh, my God, everybody around me is speaking Ebonics.
And
I have no natural accent, so let me start speaking Ebonics. And look, Lincoln Center is, like, right across the big street.
Yeah, two blocks
right
away you have people showing up for the opera. That's really cool. I think to your credit also, I mean, for how much you have moved around and, you know, gotten relocated to different schools and different types of programs and different types of communities, you really hold on to, like, all of those friends. It's really easy for you to keep up contact despite, you know, kind of only spending summer camp together.
I'm really lucky, but then that's also when you realize sometimes the people that you spend your day-to-day with are not the people you'll end up keeping in touch with.
Huh.
You know, sometimes you spend day-to-day with people, but it's just for the convenience or the ease of communicating about that daily life. And so the people who you stay in touch with sometimes are really expected. Like, even if you've only met for a semester and you've known someone else for 10 years, it doesn't necessarily mean you know each other better on a deeper level. And so the people, I don't think it's so much that I'm really good at keeping in touch, but I'm very lucky to have people who appreciate that my personality is fairly open, and then they're much more comfortable with the fact that I'm not there, but we can still open up to each other from time to time.
Hmm.
And I think that's actually where it stems from.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jenny? Did you ever feel uncomfortable when you had to switch cities or switch schools?
I think later on in my life, that wasn't a problem so much anymore. The first time was really difficult when I had to move from Paris to Shanghai. Back then I was in a very strict Catholic school in France. Very, very strict. Like,
were you Catholic?
No, I wasn't, but the school was really good. So
okay.
My Chinese parents, obviously, they were like, what's the best, you know? So you go to that school even though you have to, like, go to mass and sing.
Oh, really?
Sean,
didn't you have also, you had, like, chapel hours in high school?
We did, but I went to a private school also, but it was much smaller, and I was just telling someone the other day, like, with our international students, it's very much the, like, we just want to send our kids to a private school.
Yeah, exactly.
But they can't get into the nice private school. But they can afford a private school, so they go to our school. It's like, yeah, so we had chapel, but it was, like, once a week, just to hold on to, like, oh, yes, our school's a Methodist school. It's like, but not really. It's not like, you know.
So for us, too, like, the religious part wasn't really dominant,
mm-hmm.
but this, you know, the fact that everything was very strict was, in that sense.
Did you have a uniform?
No, but we're not allowed to wear skirts, though.
Oh.
No skirt, no makeup.
Is it just, like, dress code more?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what ours was like.
Huh. French schools don't have uniforms, so it's, like, it's very different from the UK.
I see. So do you feel like now you're making up for lost time?
What do you mean? I don't dress, you know, very scandalous.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Jenny has a collection of 365 pairs of black tights for every day of the year. For every occasion. She has her formal tights and her sleepover tights.
Separated by seasons.
Yeah, exactly.
Summer tights.
Summer tights.
So, and then later on, it wasn't that difficult anymore. I think when you're a kid, you're really obsessed with losing your friends, as opposed to, oh, what opportunity is it going to open for me? And I think after I moved to Shanghai, it was difficult at first, because you're a teenager, and anyways, you want to rebel against your parents. But after 1 year, the fact that the school was very small, that the teachers were amazing, you know, like, you really open up to something different in your life. And I think, really coming back to everything we've talked about today, I feel like I would have been a very different person if I stayed in France. So it's still the same person, but because your life experience, especially at that age, makes you different. Like, you're more open-minded, you're more eager to accept, you know, different people, different backgrounds. So I think it really utterly changed me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, later on, moving back to Europe, I didn't feel that it was difficult anymore, because I was just looking for the positive side of it.
Yeah. Since you moved back to Paris...
Again.
you just mentioned that something really tragic happened. You're not able to eat soft cheese anymore.
So, about a year ago, I started having, like, very frequent cramps in my stomach, and it was a bit weird because, you know, usually when you have that, it's because you went KTV for too long and you had way too many drinks. But this was happening, you know, just in normal weeks where there was no drinking involved or drug abuse, so it was just really strange. And about 3 months ago, the doctor told me that basically it's just a syndrome that I have, and so there are a couple of things that I have to stop eating. And it's actually quite complicated for people to live with me now, because, so for example, if you have a friend who's like lactose intolerant, and they would always be like, oh, I can't have milk in my coffee, like, you already find that pretty irritating. Why are they, you know, making this all about themselves? But for me, it's because there's so many different things that I cannot eat anymore. It's actually a pain in the ass, like, to go, like, basically outside with me.
Yeah, well, I'm really curious about your... how you don't use soap or shampoo at all.
So, basically, I think this links back to something that happened in my life, like, much earlier. When I was finishing my studies, I moved to Japan. And I felt like, back at that time, I kind of rediscovered myself.
What part of Japan?
I lived in Tokyo for 8 months. Mm-hmm. And I studied management, but also arts back there. That's something I really wanted to do, but because of my studies, elite school again, and, like, politics, so I never really indulged myself into studying arts. Mm-hmm. And that time was really away from my parents. Like, there was no one from my school there, so it was just, like, being myself and rediscovering what I would be without the weight of my culture on me. Mm-hmm. So that's living on by myself. You know, we're living in the woods because it's outside of Tokyo where I was living. It was Kunitachi City, so it's 45 minutes away from anything. And just living on my own, I started, like, eating differently. I started having a different pace of life that was not pressured, or that was not constrained by what my parents would expect me to do or my friends back in Paris. And so that's when I started feeling a little bit less constricted, like, less normed, and less groomed also, because I would just, like, go run in the woods every day and, you know, like, unwashed. I mean,
yeah.
That was something new for me. And yeah, I felt, like, this deeper connection to nature at, like, in different levels. Like, running in the woods for me was really amazing. It was just me, myself, you know, and looking disgusting, and that was great. And I think when I moved back to Paris and I started having health issues, I also kind of started questioning what I really wanted, and not what society expects you to do. And so in different levels, I started eating differently, and also, like, so the cosmetic part is only, like, a small part of it, but I also wanted to have something more natural for my body.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So explain to me how you can wash your hair with salt.
Yeah, so basically...
I've heard that, too.
Yeah.
Really?
There used to be a video. I can't remember who it was. Like, it was a music video.
Yeah, you
these
can
two
you
Asian
just
girls,
mix it
like,
together.
I think
it's
they were Japanese. And in the video, she, like, is just... The video's in reverse, but she's, like, pouring salt, like, on her hair. And I was like, what is going on?
Yeah,
and
you can just, like...
My friend was like, yeah, you can do that.
Sea salt, like, lemon juice, and then coconut oil. And you mix it together, and it's auto-conserving. You know, like, when I look at some shampoos that I left in France when I moved to China and I came back, and after 2 years they looked really, like, bad. Like,
yeah.
You know, you could see, like, the plastic was melting, the smell was different, and I was like, oh, shit, this is, like, really chemical. Why
mm-hmm.
am I using this, mm-hmm. like, on a daily basis? And so I went from, like, extreme marketing where I was testing all the new products, I was really into, like, trying new shampoos
mm-hmm.
and all that, to, like, basically this is all bullshit and I'm gonna start doing my own.
Uh-huh.
So,
can you use that for your skin and hair?
Yeah, you can use it for everything.
And you got your boyfriend to do it as well?
No, like, so my boyfriend doesn't wash with shower gel anymore, because he just doesn't believe it, and also, like, he doesn't use shampoo. So, yeah, we're, like, the unwashed couple.
You're also mentioning that there's a lot of osteopaths in France.
Yeah. So, that's something I discovered when I moved back to Paris 2 years ago. It's like, most people would be like, oh, I cannot have lunch with you, I need to go to my osteopath. And I was like, what is this thing they're talking about? Because when you grow up in China, like, you don't really know what it is.
I mean, I had never heard of anything like that before.
So they're like doctors of the bones, right? They
yeah.
see if your ligaments, if the bones are, like, well put so that the flow of energy, like, is going well inside of you. And so when I started having cramps and also back pains, I went to see different Western specialists, and one of them, who was, like, an old, like, you know, quite mature, like, doctor, told me, from echography we can't really see what the problem is, but it has maybe to see with the placement of the bones, so you have to go and see an osteopath. And basically in France, osteopaths are also, like, naturopaths, so instead of giving you strong medicine that corrects something, they prefer giving you exercises that prevent the issue from happening.
Mm-hmm.
So there are apparently different ways, like when you sleep or when you clench your teeth or the way you position yourself, that can have actually much deeper effects on your body. And I guess because now, like, we're nearly, like, 30, like, it starts wearing down, like, a little bit more than it used to when you're young. And so, yeah, now I go and see one of them, like, every so often, and he helps correct me. Not
wow.
with pills, but with exercises.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, there's a lot of holistic treatments in China as well. Clarissa, Annie, do you guys have experience with that?
I mean, nothing on that kind of, nothing on that level. But, I mean, it's just, like, here you can kind of discover the joy of, like, massages, which I think, and as well as some, like, kind of stranger techniques such as, like, cupping or scraping. Which I did try once, and then you kind of end up with these, like, very scary-looking circular dark bruises
yeah.
on your back. And I guess the idea is that the darker the coloration of the bruise, the more toxins you have. So for me, I don't know, maybe Annie has more knowledge about it. Like, I tried it as a almost as a novelty and to test whether it worked. But I'm not sure if it... I'm not sure I can say anything about the results, but
I mean, I think cupping is getting more and more popular, particularly for athletes,
because of Michael Phelps. Actually,
yeah, sure.
He single-handedly was like, "It works."
Yeah, Annie, are you and your mom still going to that masseuse?
Yeah, I mean, I.
So, how often do you have those treatments, and what are they like?
I'm getting really lazy now. I don't go to it as often, but also, like, I grew up going to chiropractors and everything, like. Sounds really weird, but when I was younger, one of my favorite things going to a chiropractor was in that moment when they're, like, gonna crick your neck back into place. You're like, that anticipation is almost like being at the precipice of a roller coaster where you're like, oh my god, it can either go really well or really badly. I don't know what's gonna happen. So that was how I kind of grew up, right? With all these, like, really traditional Chinese treatments around me. And then there was starting the company, going natural.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually a lot like you now. I go to see a homeopath. She gives me, like, a million supplements. instead of seeing an endocrinologist, yeah, and pills. But no, for me, stuff like cupping really works. So cupping, the more discoloration, it's the toxins, but also that means there's less flow of blood. So basically everything about Chinese medicine revolves around smooth blood flow, more or less.
I stayed with Annie in January of last year for the Elvis exhibition. We went to the International Elvis Fan Club birthday dinner. and Annie was so concerned because she was like, where is it? It's at a hotel. They're going to have a buffet. She was like, I would hate for you to come to Hong Kong and have one bad meal.
Forgot about that.
I was like, I'm not going for the food. I'm going for the entertainment, obviously.
I need your schedule. I need to vet all these places.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah.
This is how it is. What else are you going
to
do?
Yeah. I wish that you could have come to that party with me, but it was so overbooked. They had this ballroom in the hotel, and then they had people spilling out into, like, the vestibule, into the stairwell. I mean, everywhere that you could fit a seat, they put a table, just because they had, like, sold out so many tickets. A lot of them were, like, middle-aged Asian people, like, mostly from Hong Kong. Not the key Elvis demographic, I assumed. And I would say probably, like, 40% were doctors.
That makes sense. I would actually say you're not the target demographic for
Elvis. What would you say is the target demographic?
I don't know. I just figured there'd be more, like, white people.
Yeah,
I guess it is kind of very much a scene that I witnessed. Actually, the star of the party, the only person who is dressed as Elvis, is, I guess he's a OBGYN. Like, he delivers babies. So he has, like, a Facebook fan page, and all the comments are alternatively like, wow, like, you're an amazing Elvis performer, and thank you for so much for saving my baby's life.
So cool. Well, very well-rounded doctor.
Yeah.
I don't see that very often.
But yeah, Clarissa, maybe you could tell us about your trip to Harbin.
Well, I went to Harbin, I think, a year and a half ago.
I guess for people who aren't familiar with China, can you tell us a little bit about Harbin?
Harbin is located in the far north of China. It's the most Russian part.
That's where my family comes from.
So it's like Boston, very cold and snowy, so I immediately felt at home. And what they're known for, I guess most of all, is a famous ice festival, where they construct these magical palaces, huge, like, life-size palaces out of ice, and then they're lit up. So this was the draw, and I went with one of our friends, another honey badger, who's in America right now. And we had a good time.
Did you? Well, I'll just preface it by saying that as a bon voyage present, we bought these, like, I guess they're meant to be hand warmers. So they're, like, little, like, bottles shaped like animals, and then they come in furry sweaters. And the idea is that you're supposed to fill them with hot water. I think they were filled with whiskey. It's not just to warm your hands anymore, I guess.
They may have been a little too full of whiskey. And so, yeah, I think what I can say is that I remember a lot of colors and lights.
Yep.
and I wasn't cold at all, so it's great.
Also, I mean, you can get vodka kind of anywhere.
Vodka.
For super cheap, quote-unquote vodka, sure. Anyway, do you remember hugging Arctic foxes?
I do. That was one of my highlights. when we arrived in Harbin, we went to this, the lake had frozen over, and there had all sorts of, like, snow games, like sledding or, like, little skiing, like, ice skating. And they also had Arctic foxes that you could hug and pick up. So immediately Jen and I went, we hugged the foxes, we got our pictures.
Well, it's really expensive, right?
Not that expensive. Whatever the price was, it was worth it. that was definitely a very magical moment. And the I think our foxes were very happy as well.
Oh,
cuddling them. So it was kind of an animal intensive trip. I remember one of the moments at the ice festival. I encountered like a Russian style. It was like a sleigh pulled by a horse. And I was so happy to see the horse. Maybe too happy to see the guy. So I was like, I love you, horse, like, here. And then I accidentally gave the guy 100 kwai and he just took it and disappeared with the horse. And then the next day, we went to the tiger reserve in Harbin. And you can kind of take this, like, completely covered car through this, like, tiger habitat. And you see, like, just tons and tons of huge... you know, tigers, like, next to snow tigers, normal tigers. So, yeah, there's a lot of wildlife up in the cold, snowy north of China.
I believe that's where that guy got eaten.
Yeah.
Is it? That was at the Shanghai Zoo.
No.
Really? That video?
In Harbin, I think.
Oh, really?
In Harbin, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing is that you don't exit the car.
Much less sneak inside.
Yeah.
Inside the pen.
So, you know, I guess some people are not as careful as others.
Yeah. That was, like, the other video that went viral. It was, like, when the woman got out of her car and then a lion ate her. And then it was, like, they were blaming the zoo. And it's like, no, there's loose lions.
It's
like,
one rule.
Yeah, there's usually one rule, which is don't get out. And it's like, but I wanted to see it.
I wanted a picture.
And that's what you get.
No, that video was they got into an argument. There was an argument, so one was thrown out of the car and the other one went out, and then they both got eaten.
No!
Don't leave the car.
Just stay in the car, yeah.
I mean, also issues later.
Yeah, exactly. Like, alright, let's get out of the drive-thru zoo, and then we'll fight all the time.
I mean, it's so freezing there, I wouldn't get out of the car regardless. It's like, it gets down to like negative... 30-something?
I think so. I was slightly disappointed because it was like a warm weekend.
Oh, please. Oh, so it was like negative 20. Great. Yeah.
So about that, actually, one of my great uncles lost an ear in Harbin. So my family comes from the north, as I said.
Yeah.
They used to like do lots of drinking games in the cold, cold winter because nothing else happened.
Yeah. Wait, does your family eat ice cream outside in winter?
No. But so apparently that uncle, it's like a kind of like
cream.
A family story.
They just call it cream.
Like, they tell that to the kids, like, so that they don't get alcoholic or something. But anyways, what I was always told was that that uncle one night got really drunk and out of like a bet or something with other people from the family, he started running outside without a hat. And then his ear started being a little bit itchy. Ooh. And so he was itching it, but after running in the cold snow... And it kind of fell.
It fell?
It fell.
It fell.
So he's like the one-ear uncle. And this is what they tell the children so that they don't go crazy with drinking.
So does everybody have a one-eared uncle? Wow, what a coincidence.
It's a good thing he didn't touch his eye or something.
Oh my god. Yeah.
Do you still have family up there?
Yeah, some of like the... Like very, very... distant people, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them are still living on the grounds of the family.
I see.
Like a farm or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
My grandpa still has property in Hunan, in Fenghuang.
Have you ever been there?
I have been there. Not to the ground specifically, but to the city. During my first October holiday in China... I did the pandas in Chengdu. I paid my $300 to hug that panda.
Totally love it.
Exactly, because $300 is not expensive when it's your lifelong dream.
Small price to pay for happiness.
Exactly, exactly.
How much is it to hug Hello Kitty then?
How much is it to hug Hello Kitty? It's only about $40. It used to be when you go to Sanrio World, you can't see Hello Kitty. You have to pay to get into her house. It's a separate ticket.
She doesn't walk around the park.
No, but you can hug her twin sister, Mimi, who has a yellow bow on the opposite side.
Ah, she's a chipper.
Disney does that, too. There's
really?
Like, Mickey is in a specific, like, Mickey's house where you have to, like, go. Like, I'm sure occasionally one walks around the park, but I feel like I remember that as a kid. Like, there was a specific, like, line for Mickey.
You had to pay, probably.
I don't know if you had to pay extra. I mean, you're already in the park, but it is like a line. Like,
well, in Hillary Species world, you have to pay.
I heard at the Harry Potter experience, if you go to the wand shop, I mean, they sell you like $100 piece of plastic, and then they pick one kid, and they're like, okay, stand here, and then they're like, test this one. Oh no, this one doesn't work. And then they give him, you know, they try a different one, and then like, there's like wind in his face, and there's special effects, and things start flying out, and they go, the wand chose you, and stuff like that. I mean, it's got to be like, oh, it's so crazy, the most expensive $200 wand chose you, mom and dad.
It's a guaranteed sale. Right?
Yeah, it's genius.
Helen did that, so I would say not just for kids.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they make tons there. I'm like,
oh, yeah.
Adult. It's like, oh, I can afford my own wand. Finally!
I can buy whatever I want.
I become a banker so that I can buy as many wands as I want.
It's an investment. Well, Clarissa, what was your experience at Hello Kitty World that made you run away from us?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't function that well in little sleep. And
that's true. So we'd flown into Tokyo on not even a red eye. It, like, takes off at... It's so small of an airline that...
no one's heard of it.
No one's heard of it. They don't have people in their check-in desk. They just have kiosks. It takes off at, what, 1 o'clock?
1
a.m. And then you arrive at 5 a.m.
Oof. So we were hitting the streets of Tokyo bright and early at 6 a.m., ready to go. Fast forward to, like, 8 hours later, whatever, the afternoon at Sanrio World. We were treated to, like, this magical musical performance of Hello Kitty saving the world from a dark sorceress.
I guess it's similar to the parade at Disney World.
Okay.
I didn't know what kind of budget to expect, but, like, there are light-up floats, there are, like, light-up costumes.
There was a plot.
Yes, yeah. There's really, circus performers, there was a twist. Aerial performers.
Yeah,
the whole thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I think that was amazing.
And the people in those character costumes dance harder than anyone.
They were so into it.
They were very limber.
Japanese mascots are definitely great at their job.
Yeah.
They really
took it very seriously. But I think that was a very magical experience, which I'm very grateful for. But then after that, I think I got a little overwhelmed by the hordes of screaming children. We took a break in the Sanrio Land cafeteria, where I saw this one gentleman sleeping in the corner with a towel over his face. And that kind of stayed with me. I was like, what a genius idea. I'm so fucking
tired. Your immediate
tired.
Impression of this man sleeping at Sanrio World. Yeah, that guy's got it all figured out.
It's like
he's living his best life.
Like when you go to IKEA and they have the like play place for your kid to drop them off. But it's like the opposite. It's like you just drop your kids off at Sanrio World. Like, I'm going to go to the adult zone where it's just lounge chairs. And like.
That would be great.
It's a napping area.
So I may have copied his model. A moment. We were in line. Let me preface it by this way. We went downstairs into the basement to wait in line for a...
To see Gudetama, the lazy egg.
The lazy egg. But it was also a Gudetama airline experience. So after flying for, you know, all night, waiting in lines in Pudong Airport, I was now facing the same experience in Sanrio Land. And the line was 45 minutes, so I think that's when I kind of hit my limit, and it was like, I just went through this in the airport, like, 8 hours ago, I can't do this.
Actually, within the experience, there's a Gudetama immigration control.
That's when it hit me. Yeah. I was like, wait, we're doing this again? so I took a brief nap, then, in the cafeteria.
Yeah.
But after that, I was very rejuvenated.
Good. Yeah, I was a little bit worried because we couldn't find you for a while, and then you left the park to go sit outside in the sun like a human being. And we found you at Starbucks, and I was like, oh, I hope you're not too bored. But I realized, I mean, for people living in China, getting to use free Facebook and Instagram. Yeah. It was like a vacation for us.
It was amazing. I got my chai tea lattes. My one thing I missed from America, I would say. For some reason, the geniuses at China Starbucks decided not to include chai tea lattes in the menu here. So whenever I travel, it's my thing. So I was very happy.
All right, so we only had 2 days in Tokyo. We were going out. I planned to go out because one of my friends from growing up, Lauren, she was coming to Japan for the first time for her 30th birthday with her parents. So I said, well, you're in my hemisphere, so, like, we'll just go out and see you for the weekend, and then, you know, I'll go back to work. She was like, no, you don't have to, you know, if you were just there, it's not a big deal. I was like, no, it's Tokyo, don't really need a reason. So during that time, I had a pretty strict itinerary worked out. It was, like, just me dragging you guys along to all my favorite places. So Lauren and I, and then Clarissa, we had talked about doing a quick trip to Tokyo to see Hello Kitty together for a long time. And then our other friend Logan, who has never been to Japan before. So we were like, oh my god, you're gonna love it. Tokyo is so crazy. And I was like, we're building up too much. We're gonna go there, nothing's gonna happen. It's gonna be like so boring, like it's gonna be like totally normal. So we land at 5 a.m. We go to Shibuya, we drop our stuff at the hotel. We have a couple hours to kill before we meet up with Lauren at like 10:30 or so with her family. So I just go, let's just walk around because nothing is open. We walk from Shibuya to Harajuku and see the Meiji Shrine. So we got our requisite culture out of the way immediately.
It's very difficult.
Yes. And then by that time, things were kind of almost about to open in the next 10 or 15 minutes. So we're walking around, I'm asking, you know, like, do you guys just want to, like, grab breakfast, or do you want to wait until the stores open? We stop outside this building, and there's, you know, the signpost for all of the stores that are inside for each floor. On the third or fourth floor, there's a poster, it's bright pink, it's like pink sun rays coming out. There's cartoon characters.
Basically a magnet for us.
Cartoon characters floating around amongst breads. Different breads and pastries, right? We're like, what is this store? What could this possibly be? The name of the store is Moosh. With three O's. So we're like, what is Moosh? What is Moosh? I'm like, well, like, why don't we go check it out? I mean, we just go upstairs. We can, you know, go see what it is. They go, oh, no, no, no. You know, is it a private building? Whatever, whatever. I'm like, no, like, it's fine. We'll just, like, go and check it out. We go upstairs. We get out of the elevator. Already outside the door, there's a family waiting with several preteen girls. So we're like, all right, so like...
This is the place to be.
Yeah, I mean, we're like ahead of the crowd. Like, we gotta, you know, it's only gonna be 10 minutes. Like, let's just wait it out. In that 10 minutes, the entire hallway fills with preteen girls. Oh, and by this time, we're getting so hyped. We have no idea what's in there. We're just like, we do not belong here. Like, these guys are gonna rip our heads off for being second in line. Like, it's gonna be a bloodbath. Like,
is this like a birthday party that everyone's been invited to except for us?
Yeah, is it like, is it like a craft store? Is it a bakery? We have no idea. And also, like, the parents are just looking like very, I mean, they're so like distraught and bored.
But there's like tension in the air from these like preteens. Yes. Like, there was hype. Everybody was so excited.
Yeah.
The family in line even like tried to creak open the door to see if like we could enter.
So I mean, we're running on fumes at this point. We're so tired. So we're just like giggling hysterically. Like, I mean, we're like the only ones making noise in the hallway. All these other girls are like so uncomfortable because there's grown ass women. Just like there for no reason, laughing maniacally. Let me just note that at this point I have bright pink hair and a Pikachu backpack on. Not proud. So we're like making up like like ad campaigns for Moosh were like, what if Justin Bieber is their spokesperson? The commercial is like, it's like the Big Bang, like expanding the universe, and then Justin Bieber, like his back is to the camera. Moosh. And the tag comes up, Justin Bieber for Moosh, because all of his fans are already in this hallway. Okay, so finally the door opens. There's a mad rush inside. I mean, there's
a gasp of joy.
There's like girls like screaming around us from both sides to like push into this door. So how would you describe it at first glance?
Colors, and I thought we were in a bakery.
Yeah, I mean it's like an all white room. There's tables and counters along the wall, and then there's a bunch of like baskets with individually wrapped packages in each one. So each package has like one piece of bread in it, different types of bread, different types of pastry. In the center, there's a table covered with samples. So there's some of the cartoon characters from the poster. There's some breads and pastries. Most of the tables have like pink checkered tablecloths, and then there's like rainbow streamers on the wall and more like cartoon posters. But then this middle table, it's not a tablecloth. There's no plates. It's fun fur.
Wait,
what? Yeah. So like you're putting your edibles down on this fur? Furry table.
Like shag fur.
So we go up to get a piece of bread.
And then the realization hits.
It's not real bread. They're like plastic stress ball toys, like squishy stress ball toys.
Priced like at $30 each one. And we see people around us throwing them like joyfully into their baskets and like squeezing different ones.
So these poor dads are following their daughters around with these shopping carts like of 5, 10, 15 toys. So the idea,
foam bread.
The idea is that you like you can squeeze them, right? So you like moosh them.
Does a different filling come out of them? What's the
no? What they're the, just foam the stress
no,
balls.
They don't do anything.
Okay. Some of them were scented.
Some of them were scented.
Moosh.
So for the rest of the weekend, anytime something insane happened that we couldn't explain, it was like amazing. We just go, shh, mush. That's the only reason. I would say at that point, I mean, like, our promise to Logan delivered like dominoes. It, like, walking around the street in Harajuku afterwards, like, we ran into like this TV show filming. It was a bunch of schoolgirls wearing fake beards, having to eat food on sticks like kebabs and corn dogs.
They were so nice.
Thank
like,
you, Tokyo,
hi.
For never disappointing.
Never. So we were heading back to Shanghai like at midnight on Sunday night, and you know, we were just like recalling all of our exciting activities that we had done. Because, I mean, we covered, like, a full week tour in 2 days.
We walked 50,000 steps.
Yeah. So, Logan starts to make the list. She goes, yeah, like, we went to Moosh, we saw the girls filming the TV show, we went to San Real World, we went to the Ramen Museum. We go, no, before Moosh, we went to the temple. She goes, no, and we didn't do that. We go, yeah, like, When we arrived, like after we dropped our stuff at the hotel, we walked over to this, you know, like giant
major cultural.
It's like the biggest shrine in Tokyo.
And it's like in the center of the city.
Yeah.
Yeah. She goes, no, we didn't. Like before Moosh, she just blacked out everything.
Before Moosh, there was nothing.
Before Moosh, there was nothing.
Did you buy one?
No, budget, are you kidding me?
Not only is it a whole store of these stress balls, but they're like $30 US. Like, I looked up their website. Like,
yeah.
Oh my god. Like,
do you know how much real bread you can buy for $30?
She was saying they did like that pin pineapple pen collaboration.
Oh my god.
$40, $50. It's like, what?
Cool. Thanks so much, you guys. I'm so glad to have us all back together again.
Love it when you look at me, baby.
Your lips, your smile.